Thanks a lot for joining us. I'm really pleased that Matt was able to come here. We've had a chance to talk to each other a couple times in the past. And what strikes me is you're one of the London tech scene's true pioneers. You helped to develop the first magazine publishing platform for the iPad, which Steve Jobs himself hailed as the king of the hill back in, I think, 2009 or thereabouts. You were the inspiration for Tech City, this whole government initiative. It was Matt who actually got that going by saying he could, you know, entrepreneurs living in this part of London could really use some help. And also, you continue to make really interesting, sometimes off the wall, actually mostly off the wall, products that marry the, or you know, blend the physical and digital worlds. So what I wanted to start by asking is, when someone asks you what you do, how do you answer that question?
Have a lot of fun, mainly. Nowadays, I say I have a tech startup. I run a company. I think that's changed a lot. It used to be I work in technology. Then for a while it was I work in design. That was an important thing, although I wasn't a designer. I was just surrounded by designers. And gradually it came to be I have a business, and that's kind of how I identify myself.
Mm-hmm. So. And that's enough? Does that start the conversation or does that stop the conversation?
Usually, like if it's kind of like, do people want to know what I do? And I pull my phone out, there's a picture of a little printer there.
Yeah.
And I go, I make weird gadgets for the home that are connected to the internet. mostly they have faces.
Okay.
And that kind of starts things.
Okay. You know. So it was mentioned that you have a degree in physics at Oxford. I mean, that's the kind of thing that would get you a real job. So why did you want to be an entrepreneur?
I didn't realize I could start a company until my mid-20s. But what happened when I was doing physics was I encountered the web for the first time, 96. And so when I was a kid, I used to make magazines at school. Mm-hmm. So I used to make these little magazines, desktop publishing, you know, and you had to photocopy them. And I had to persuade my friend's dad, who had a company, to let me photocopy the magazines on his machine, right, which cost money, right?
Right.
So I made like 100 magazines every few weeks, and I'd sell them for 3 pence each, which is the cover price, but it was tedious selling them to people. So I had 4 distributors, and I'd sell them the magazines at 2.5p each.
Wow.
And they would sell them, and they would make maybe 20p each, you know, 10p each for the tuck shop.
Right.
I found the web, and I realized I can get stuff into people's hands, and I can create without having to go through any of this distribution, without having to beg people to use a photocopier. And when I first encountered the web and programming,
right,
I was like, oh my God, I can make things and get them in people's hands. And this is a social medium. I have to work in this.
So love of money and laziness.
Laziness is much underrated as a quality. It was only later I realized that I could do a business in this. Like you don't grow up. I didn't grow up realizing you could start your own thing. Mm-hmm. That wasn't, you know, that wasn't something that occurred to me. But the idea that I could create and other people could see it, that was the thing.
So the theme of this talk is the Internet of Things, and I feel like we may have got the crowd here under false pretenses, because you don't actually use that term yourself, right? You talk about connected hardware. Why is that the Internet of Things, which is a big kind of trend in technology, not something that particularly interests you, at least as an idea?
So Internet of Things is a useful term, but it feels very so vague, so nebulous to me that maybe it doesn't mean anything anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that you work or you create in Internet of Things is a bit like saying you work with plastics or electricity.
Yeah.
It's like, well, electricity is everything from power stations to cars to, you know, the circuitry on the Mars rover to power stations to, you know, it's everything,
okay,
right?
All right.
So Internet of Things has been, it's a useful term, but maybe everything is going to be networked. You know, maybe the internet is not always going to be trapped behind glass. Maybe everything will have the network in it eventually, and at that point, what do we call it? So there are new terms, I think. Okay.
So what makes something interesting to you then? Because you are working, I guess, in a little subsection of the Internet of Things. What makes something a Berg product or a Berg project?
Okay, so I think for me it gets interesting when we start thinking about, I really like products. I like things that people can touch and use. So, you know, Internet of Things includes smart cities. You know, there's a project in Cambridge where they can tell when the bins are full, or they're working on this, right, when the bins are full, because when the bin isn't full, you don't need to send someone around to pick stuff up. Okay. So I'm kind of like, that's interesting, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't get my pulse racing.
Right.
What does interest me is when you make products that sit in people's homes where the person who's using it is also the person who buys it, because then they will tell their friends and you can tell whether you have a good thing or not.
Okay.
And then you can start adding services to the products. And that's where it gets really interesting. You can start telling stories with it. So that's what we work in.
And how big is that opportunity? Because, you know, the web itself, which you mentioned, is nearly 25 years old, right? I think it's this March, its anniversary. So we know the impact that that's had on our lives. What about connected devices, connected hardware, these sorts of things you're talking about? Will that be transformative on the same level?
I think so. The analogy I use is actually electricity. So back in the 1880s and 1890s, the electric light bulb and the telegraph transformed cities. But it's interesting to see what they were used for to mm-hmm. begin with. You know, the electric light bulb was used so people could work late at night at home. And it was also used to make it easy to go into city centers to do shopping. Really, like,
yeah.
And for 30 years, that's what we used electricity for. And then with the fractional horsepower motor, there was an explosion of different devices. And domestic life was changed forever with washing machines and hair dryers. So I think with smartphones, that's the light bulb and the telegraph moment, okay, right? That's the thing. But when do we diversify?
Right.
And it might not happen right now, but I think it changes the network, the liveness, the ability to have the product, the small brain in the product, but then to have access to the big brain of the entire internet. Like, that'll change every product we use eventually.
So tell me about Little Printer, which is your first sort of big product. I mean, you've made other products before, but this is the one that got you a lot of attention. What was the thinking behind that? Because when we're talking about big transformation, Little Printer is a little product. It's a cute, novel product. But why did you go first with that? What was your intention?
Okay. It was a Trojan horse. So way back, we've had some experience with connected devices before, and we learned a lot about what's easy to do, what's hard to do, where the pain points are, that kind,
right,
of thing. And we came up with a kind of a mythical architecture for us, a kind of technology that we called Bird Cloud. We didn't know what it was, but we were like, can we make it easy to, can we lower the cost of invention? Can we make it easy to prototype products? And can we bring some of the web thinking, which we regard as very iterative and very agile, to physical things?
Right.
But we knew, like, I have a principle, you can't just make a platform, right? Like, it's untested.
Right.
You can only make it by being product-led. You have to kind of get your hands dirty, make something, and kind of use that, and then extract the platform later. So we brainstormed 20 different connected devices we could make. And the printer stood out because it was something where we could increase the value of it over time because of content, right? You can add more stuff to it to make it more valuable. And that kind of met another couple of ideas in the studio. And the studio is an interesting thing because it means there's no single inception for ideas. You bring things together. Mm-hmm. It met two other ideas. One idea it met was an idea I had a few years before, which was called My Printer, My Social Letterbox.
Right.
And the idea was that could the printer be the same as the way my mum used to take clippings from newspapers and send them to me? And I really loved that, the feeling that created when something comes into your life like that.
Right.
I was like, could we do that? And the second thing was Jack, my co-founder, he had had an idea for all it was a printer that prints its own face. And that was it. And designers have a kind of a sixth sense for magic, I think. And so we kind of combined all these things and started making something. And that was where Little Printer came from.
Okay. So has it worked out the way you hoped? I mean, how successful is Little Printer?
We've sold about 3,000 units.
Right.
So not wildly successful. It's not going to be the next iPad.
Right.
But we sell them as fast as we can make them. So we've learned a lot about supply chain. It turns out we can't make them very fast. But it's done the job it needed to.
Right.
And it's taught us things about how to make useful tools for connected devices that, as far as I can see, nobody else has realized are important.
Okay. So what's the most instructive lesson you've learned through Little Printer?
That we don't know what connected devices are when you start making them. You only know what they are when they're in your hands. We know this from websites and apps, right?
Right.
You know, Google Analytics was transformative for websites because you could put something out there, see how people used it, and get into a test, build, you know, an iterative loop. Achieve product market fit, you know, find your way to it. And we're kind of used to doing that with websites, but it's never been possible with hardware before. You would make it, you would ship it, and that would be it. You were stuck with products in inventory, right? Yeah. So by making products measurable and making them learn, we can iterate from a starting product to something which is better. And that's what's different, I think, once you start connecting things to the network. You can act a bit more like the web. So we're all about how do we become more agile.
Okay. All right. So I'm interested in how little printers change, but maybe we'll move on from that just for a second. Mm-hmm. And you've gone through a radical change, or Berg has gone through a radical change since I last saw you 1 year ago, right? Mm-hmm. So you described yourself as a design consultancy
right.
up until fairly recently.
Yeah.
Now you're betting on the cloud. Your big thing is Berg Cloud. Tell me about the change and the reason for the change.
Right. So since Jack and I started the company in 2005 as a design partnership, and right from the beginning we had this kind of aspiration to make our own stuff and consult. But consultancy was definitely the lead.
Right.
2009 we started hiring people, and for the next 4 years we were consulting. So we were making video phones for Google. We made that the first magazine for iPad you mentioned. We've done computer vision stuff with Samsung. And it's all been, you know, kind of, that's time and materials. That's kind of how that business works.
Right.
And then there was a moment at the end of December 2012 where we shipped Little Printer, and we'd just been named by Fast Company as this kind of, you know, great list.
Yeah.
And my old business plan that I wrote back in 2006, the long-term goal was to be a renowned consultancy and to have shipped our own product. And in December, I reckon I should have felt delighted, but I didn't. I felt, we're done. Let's go home, right? We've done everything. At the same time, we kind of realized that this split between consultancy and trying to build our own thing was tearing the company apart.
Right.
Like, it didn't feel good in the company. So we decided to choose, what should we do? And at the beginning of this year, we decided to concentrate on the technology business. Took 8 months to raise money. Now we've taken funding.
Right.
We've turned the consultancy off. So none of that anymore. Most of the team came with us. And we're now a tech startup. And yeah, that's different in lots of ways.
And how's it going so far?
Great things and difficult things.
Yeah.
So the focusing is wonderful. So we actually have a clear strategy now. It used to be that Berg was about, let's be choosy with the work, scratch our own itches,
yeah.
Try and make great fireworks.
Yeah.
Now we have a strategy. You know, there's something we're trying to build. I've got a boss for the first time in almost a decade. Well, a board, sorry, but it feels like a boss. Like
yeah.
It's a very odd feeling.
What's the sort of thing that they tell you to do that you weren't expecting?
So the incredible thing about the investors is they are like the smartest business people I've ever met, because I think just they've seen loads. So we had our first board meeting 2 weeks ago, and you're kind of talking for like 20 minutes around, you know, how you think, I don't know, our strategy, you know, these are the three or four things we should be concentrating on. And they're kind of staring at you with these kind of little beady eyes. And then they say something like incredibly insightful that you hadn't even realized was important.
Yeah.
And you're like, how did you even get to that? How did right. you even realize that was the thing? And you realize that was the most important thing you should be concentrating on. And it's just, yeah.
How will that kind of accountability change your priorities or change how you run the company? Because that's the thing is, when you take funding, you're answerable to someone, right? It's one thing having a vision, but when it's on someone else's dime, you know, they get to at least try to steer you in a certain direction.
Right, but the thing is that the thing they've bought into is the vision that Jack and I already set out for them.
Right.
So we haven't felt, and maybe this is something that happens later, we haven't felt at all like we're being steered one way or another.
Okay.
They're helping us refine it. I think the impact is more on other people in the company.
All right.
So for the first time now, everyone can see what the company is doing for the next, you know, years, right?
Yeah.
And so how they fit into that too.
Is it public how much you raised?
Yes. So we raised £800,000.
Okay.
So $1.3 million. It's not that much.
Yeah.
That's actually less than our annual revenue as a consultancy.
Right.
So we'll need to make a little revenue out of that as well.
Is that what you were aiming for? Because presumably, given your success thus far, you probably could have got more.
Yeah, but the valuation would have spoiled us, I think. Like, people are very skeptical of a company which is coming out of a consultancy mindset,
right?
Because you have a very different way of behaving. And that's actually a lot of baggage. Okay. So we were aiming for 750,000 to make it worth it.
Right.
From 750 to 1 million, like anywhere in that bracket.
Okay.
So we now have another 200 available. I think 80 of that has gone now.
Right.
But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you about Tech City. You are credited, you know, when I did the story about the London tech scene that was in Wired UK earlier this year, when David Rowan asked me to do it, who's the editor, he's the first person he said I need to talk to is Matt Webb, this guy right here. And which is incredible to begin with when you think about all the amazing people in this scene right now. But you were the guy who basically, well, you did, you inspired what the government then did, which was to create Tech City. What was the origins of that? What was the impetus for that?
So, you know, it's a friend of mine, Matt Bidoff, who came up with the term Silicon Roundabout. So he was based just up there in Transworld House, just by the roundabout.
Which is an extremely ugly building that's always been scheduled to be, as long as I've known it, it's been scheduled to be renovated or knocked down, I think.
And that
it's
was
still around.
That was the one the beach ball fell off the other week and blew around the
that
roundabout.
One, that other one, yeah.
I think there's something about the ugliness of Tech City that makes it work, by the way. So I'm kind of sad to see the fancy new buildings. But at the time, Matt's naming of the area, another Matt, the naming of the area was really, you know, I really latched onto it because so many of my friends had left for San Francisco. And also I felt a real lack of support in the area. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like whenever you tried to do something new, there was kind of a psychical pushback just from people going, really, you're going to do that? So I commissioned some research from a friend to look, Georgina Voss, to look at, does Silicon Roundabout really exist?
Right.
And she went and talked to loads of people, and her conclusion was, everyone thinks it exists, but they're not part of it. So that was like weird.
Yeah.
But the term we came up with between us was that it hadn't ignited yet.
Right.
That the kindling was there, but it hadn't ignited. Now, of course, at the meantime, there's loads of people doing other things. So, you know, Richard Moross at Moo had got his little group of people who were working in Moo offices, you know, Doppler, where Matt Bidoff was, and a few other people. So that was happening. Mike Butcher and Elizabeth Valia started Tech Hub, so that was happening. So there was kindling.
Mm-hmm.
Then I randomly got invited on this trade mission to India with, like, the UK government and David Cameron. I have no idea how, right? No idea how.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted, like, a small business who would kind of just, look, we support small businesses, right? And I wasn't going to go.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to go. I don't know if you remember the big student riots in Trafalgar Square where there was like, you know, I was like, I can't support a government like this, right? So I was going to say no. And then my cousin and my girlfriend, now wife, sat me down and they were like, every time you have more than two beers, you start ranting about how there's a lack of small business support in this country.
Yeah.
And you've got this opportunity to go and talk to people who could help and you're not going to do it.
Right.
So I went on the trip. And I got talking to Rohan Silver there. And I said, there's something going on in East London. What would you do if you were me? Not expecting anybody to do anything. And conversations. And then Rohan got David Cameron to turn up at the Truman Brewery that November and go, this is Tech City, everyone come here. Right? And it's a supply side problem. So then you have people just turning up going, what's going on?
Right.
Then the lawyers turn up. We need lawyers.
Yeah.
Then the VCs turn up, and you know, so my role was only ever catalytic. I didn't actually do anything.
Problem, though, is if I recall, was that you were coming up against challenges, and there weren't people there who'd had the experience who could help you fix that or get around that, right?
Right.
So you were thinking that the government could kind of have a role in that. Because it became, I mean, I was at that event. I got myself invited at the very last minute. But it had, you know, David Cameron, Boris Johnson, and you know, lots of really notable entrepreneurs, including Brent Hoberman, Michael Birch. So guys who'd built successful businesses. I'm sure you were there, but I didn't know you at the time. That really did ignite. I mean, you must be incredibly surprised at how that idea has caught on.
Right. So the great thing about it is that loads of people, out of self-interest, want it to succeed, but for different reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. The government needs to succeed because they need an economic success.
Right.
The VCs want to succeed because it's easier for them to meet people all in one place. Right? The companies wanted to succeed for like co-marketing. So everyone wants it to succeed for different reasons. And I'm a big believer in finding things that lots of people can want to happen for actually often contradictory reasons. Mm-hmm. It's a way of getting people who will disagree with each other to play along.
Mm-hmm.
Also the fact that it's Tech City and Silicon Roundabout. You don't have to agree with Tech City because you've got this slightly countercultural, we're taking the mick out ourselves name mm-hmm. as well. So it's a way for lots of people to play along.
Did it change something? Was there a meaningful change that resulted from Tech City though? I mean, are you better off as a result of Tech City than you were beforehand?
Right, so two tangible things. A legal firm started putting on free workshops to negotiate a term sheet. I'd never seen a term sheet in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that one day I would need to see one. So I went along, I encountered it for the first time,
mm-hmm.
and you know that's been useful. So the question is, how did that event happen? And the reason that event will have happened is somebody in that legal firm will have said, well, I've heard of this Tech City thing, because I've read about it in The Economist or the FT, and it's legit, because Number 10 are behind it, or Google, who've got Google Campus. And so they're able to use that evidence to allow them to put an event on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of one reason. Those kind of things are good. The second useful thing is there are now venture capitalists in the area. And one of the reasons they're here is over the last few years, they've invested in a few companies. Say, you know, they're from the States, and now they travel to London for board meetings. So I was emailing someone, and I was like, I'd like to talk. And they were like, as luck would have it, I'm in London next week. So what happens is you bring people together, and suddenly you have this marketplace thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, you know, for VCs, also read talent. Or running into someone in the coffee shop queue going, I'm trying to think about how to solve this issue. What do you think? So you've basically created a serendipity machine, which is a geographic district, which is what clusters are, really.
And is that beyond the term sheet? Is that helping you day to day? Because, you know, I also had the benefit of talking to Richard Florida. So I met with Rohan Silva at Downing Street when I was doing that piece, and he talked about Richard Florida, who was like sort of the philosophical inspiration. You were the kind of entrepreneur on the ground. Richard Florida, for anyone who doesn't know, is an urban theorist who kind of is an acolyte of Jane Jacobs, who talked about the productivity that comes from proximity and how governments, I think, or at least how tech clusters can form in urban environments, and that's kind of the future, whereas in the past it would have been in suburban research parks. Do you are now, I think, on the corner of Silicon Way, is that right? Are you still based there? Have you moved to new offices?
So here's the thing, we had to move.
Okay.
Because the building is getting knocked down for offices because commercial rent has doubled in the last 12 months.
Right.
Because of Tech City.
Is that your fault?
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, Hackney called it Silicon Way.
Right. But you never regret that?
The rent doubling?
Yeah.
No, it happens.
Yeah.
So one of the things about changing to a tech startup is all our processes are broken. We don't know how to do anything anymore.
Right.
In the old days, we would have had to figure this out for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
This time what we did is we had an offsite. Where do we have it? At a place around the corner. 4 years ago, there was nowhere to have events.
Right.
Who did we get to coach us? Someone that another startup recommended because they'd had great experience with her coaching them about the processes.
Mm-hmm.
And that will change how we work.
And when I asked you about the day-to-day, because you know I've had the benefit, as I say, of covering technology. So when I come to East London, I used to live here, but when I come here, I go to Google Campus or I go to Mind Candy. You haven't invited me by your office recently, so I haven't been there. But you know, I get this impression of these wonderful things, you know, exciting things happening. And then some people are quite skeptical. They think Tech City is just a government initiative that's meant to, I don't know, win votes, and there's nothing really behind it. So you kind of are aware of the big picture, but in the day to day, are you running into other entrepreneurs? That sort of San Francisco kind of ecosystem that we discussed before in Valencia, where you kind of run into other people who are doing something similar? Is that happening?
So Alexandra de Champs-Encino is the heart of the Internet of Things scene in London.
Right.
She's a friend now, so I can drop her a note. We met up for coffee. We were sitting in Ozone, and I was like, you know, I'm really trying to think about who I need to pitch this thing to, get more embedded in the scene. She was like, you need to talk to this guy, John. He runs at what is now Techstars. And she's like, I'll intro him to you. And then we turn around, and he's four seats down. So we go and talk to him.
Yeah.
Sees my face, we meet up, I end up getting invited to another event up in Cambridge,
right.
Meet some people there. This kind of stuff is happening continuously.
Okay, cool.
And so tiny accelerations.
I want to bring it back to your company because we only have a few minutes left. So one of the things we talked about was a big shift to Bird Cloud. So you're making products. We should talk about the thing you did for Twitter, with Twitter, which is Flock, the tweeting cuckoo clock.
Should we?
Yeah, maybe we should look at the video. That would be great.
Let's have the video running in the background.
Yeah, okay.
So I'll tell you, you know, while that's going on, because I think it's just, it's nice ambient stuff.
And I want to ask you, because we don't have that much time, you're making your own cool products, but you're also opening up to developers.
Right.
So tell me quickly how this came about.
Right, so the big shift for us was we made Little Printer, we extracted this platform for making connected things more easily, lowering the cost of invention. We called Bird Cloud, and we were like, that was like a ta-da moment for us. It hadn't occurred to us that we could really make other stuff on it, but we still needed to prove it. It's not a platform until you've got more than one thing on it. And around the same time, Twitter had come to us and said, you know, we kind of got known for making connected things. We also got made known for making little things. So we also got people coming to us going, could you make us some little sofas? And we were like, are they connected to the internet? And they were like, no. they're just little. You're the guys who do little things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we were like, no.
We have standards.
Anyway, so Twitter came to us and said, can you help us make a connected cuckoo clock that we will give away as a marketing thing?
Right.
That sings when you get a tweet. So you could see from that the birds come out when you get a new follower, a retweet, whatever. Wow. So we start working on the product over here. And we're 2 months into the project, you know, at work. It's a slow burn one. And we're also working on Bird Cloud. And I remember the day when I got these guys into a room and I was like, how are you building this flock, this connected cuckoo clock? And they're like, oh, a bunch of Arduinos and some web stuff and, you know, the industrial design. And I'm like, do you know how you're going to do that yet? And they were like, no, we're still trying to figure it out. I said, talk to the guy who was building Bird Cloud. And I was like, how close are you to having Bird Cloud ready that we can build stuff on it? And he's like, it's kind of there. And I'm like, our company is only 14 people. Why are you two guys not talking to each other yet? And we sort of stared at each other for 5 minutes. And then they were like, you know, we probably should do that. And it was funny. Even we, it hadn't occurred to us that we could yet use Bird Cloud for things that weren't our own products, that it would accelerate other things.
Right.
So we brought this out, and that was the first test case of could other people build products on the platform. Now, we're not going to make any more products on the platform, not for the next year or so.
Wow.
We're going to make kits to help other people make products.
So are you trying to inspire another kind of Raspberry Pi type ecosystem based around Bird Cloud?
The Raspberry Pi ecosystem already exists, as does an Arduino one. So what we want to do is work with those groups of people, help them connect what they're doing to the web, and make new products out of that.
Okay.
So the long-term game is somebody somewhere is going to make the internet fridge, you know, the proverbial internet fridge, and they're going to make a good one. I want to be the platform that drives that.
Okay.
You know, I want to be the iOS of the connected washing machine, the connected weigh scales, the connected table lamp. This is kind of a dark video, and it's got the original company name there, Schultz and Webb. This was the first thing we made back in 2005, released it in 2006. And it's a puppet, a little, you know, a physical puppet. It was meant to be injection molded in the body and 3D printed in the head to look like one of your friends. And it would represent one of your friends when they were available online on instant messengers to talk to.
Right.
And you can see it plugs into your computer by USB. Nobody uses USB now.
Right.
And it represents one of your friends on IM. Nobody uses instant messaging. And it says when they're available to chat. I haven't been offline since like 2009. but I want to show you at work. So
okay.
Can you hit play? So what it is, this puppet represents one of your friends, and there they are plugged into your computer. And here they are on IM. And they go offline. They come online. See if you can guess what happens next. We were going to be billionaires.
Please join me in thanking Matt Webb from Bird.
Thank you.